William Gibson has been described as the noir prophet of cyberpunk science fiction. He actually coined the word cyberspace in his 1982 short story Burning Chrome. He took it even further in his most famous novel, Neuromancer. The first winner of science fiction's Triple Crown, the Nebula Award, the Philip K. Dick Award, and the Hugo Award. Why did Gibson coin the word cyberspace?
What I needed in 1981 was an evocative and essentially meaningless word which would substitute for me in a work of science fiction for space and the spaceship, because space and the spaceship were the arena in which science fiction had predominantly played out in my lifetime. And neither of those worked for me in 1981 as a place where I could set fiction. I wanted something completely new. And through a rather roundabout process, I found myself one day sitting with a yellow legal pad and a red Sharpie printing imaginary words in block capitals. And I think I had info space and data space, neither of which worked poetically for me, neither of which would have really had any legs in the English language if I had chosen them instead. I think if I had chosen either infospace or data space, we wouldn't be talking now. When I got to cyberspace, it rolled off the tongue and sat there in red Sharpie on the yellow legal pad, looking as though it had always been there. And I thought, I'll go with that. It was a hollow signifier when I coined it. It meant nothing. It was absolutely devoid of meaning. And that was also what I had wanted, so that I could then begin to fill it in fiction with meaning to, I hoped, the pleasure of the reader.
Well, and it meant that you had a chance then to not be Robert Heinlein or Isaac Asimov. You had a place that you could write a distinctly William Gibson universe.
Yes, and I don't know if I would have put it that way at the time, but that was actually what I was looking for and what drove me to coin it. There's the subsequent but understandable confusion as to whether or not I invented cyberspace, and I didn't. What happened was I coined a word, came up with a number of completely imaginary definitions and descriptions of something called that, but the word somehow escaped from my text into the language at large and began to be used to describe what we were doing in what we still, by and large, call cyberspace, if indeed we have to call it anything. I think if it's not already slightly archaic, I think it eventually will be, if only because the distinction between that which is cyberspace and that which isn't is vanishing.
Well, I'm really curious, because you said you had a couple of definitions of it at the time. How would you have described cyberspace in 1981?
If I had a copy of Neuromancer with me, which I don't, I could find you the paragraph in Neuromancer which does exactly that.
Cyberspace, a consensual hallucination experienced daily by billions of legitimate operators in every nation, by children being taught mathematical concepts, a graphic representation of data abstracted from the banks of every computer in the human system, unthinkable complexity, lines of light ranged in the non-space of the mind, clusters and constellations of data, like city lights receding.
By 1991, when people would ask me to define it, I'd tell them that it's where the bank keeps their money. Which it literally is. It's where the stock market is transacted. It's increasingly where your medical records are. It's increasingly where we do everything of any informational importance. And simultaneously, it has no geographical location and is global. And now, I think we're over into another era of cyberspace in which cyberspace is colonizing the physical world in ways that most of us aren't entirely conscious of.
It's interesting, isn't it, that something that was entirely imaginary when you started has evolved and taken on, if not a reality of its own, an existence of its own.
I knew in 1981 that there was an internet, to the extent that there was an internet in 1981, which wasn't very much. I had actually had friends who, after like a really grueling ham radio-like learning curve, were sometimes able to connect their computers to the computers of friends in foreign countries and exchange messages. And I thought, that's going to be exponentially easier one day. And that was one of the observations that led to the creation of my first imaginary cyberspace in my early fiction.
A lot of your nonfiction focuses on cities. You've written about Tokyo. You've written about New York City. Is there something particularly about cities that you find compelling?
Cities are engines for the generation of emergent technologies. Once cities were in place, relatively few technologies emerged directly from rural situations. I think that cities are in themselves a sort of meta technology. It's impossible to have a city without a deep and pyramidal substrate of technologies. The very bottom line being that hunter-gatherers can't do cities. You can't do a city until your society has technologies in place that allow it to reliably obtain and store food. That's the bottom line. And usually it would mean cereals or something like that. You need an agricultural base and a way to store, you know, long-term storage of cereals or rice, which enables you then to keep a large population in one place and keep them working on your city project. Beyond a certain number, and I think it's actually a fairly specific number, your city will die of disease and overpopulation unless you've been able to master sewage technology. And that nearly did for London a couple of times with the cholera.
Things have changed these days. Technology, the emergent technologies that you're so excited about, that you believe are moving social change, have come up with a lot of odd things. What do you think about social media sites like Facebook and Twitter?
Well, I think that the internet is something, in the broadest sense, on the order of a city. I think the internet is the next thing we've done as a species after cities. It's a sort of plateau. And on that plateau, it seems wholly natural to me that we would evolve means of social interaction, that there would be places to go and places to be with other people. It would be interesting to know whether in 50 years, say, social media resemble anything at all the social media that we have today. I think that's probably unknowable.
In your collection, Distrust That Particular Flavor, the last piece is called Googling the Cyborg. It's a transcript of a talk you gave for the Vancouver Institute. In there, you describe the internet as your cybernetic organism. Can you explain what you meant by that?
In that talk, I described the advent of our myth of the cyborg, of the quasi-robot human, the guy with the chip in his head and various other accessories. And that's been a big 20th century piece of mythology for us. It pops up everywhere. It's very familiar. Little children would get it if you showed them a drawing of that sort of cyborg. But what I wind up saying in that talk is that I don't think we're going there, but that that is a sort of cultural symbol that we've had of where we actually are going. And where we actually are going, I imagine, judging where we've already gone in my lifetime, is somewhere where we are all, to some extent, interconnected almost all of the time to an unprecedented degree. And that mass of constantly interconnected human beings accessing all sorts of artificial prosthetic memory constitutes a new stage of the human experience and probably indicates some further direction, which I would assume is quite unimaginable to us today.
I know you've just said that a future, anyway, is unimaginable, but do you see technology evolving, and do you have any ideas about how it's going to evolve, how it will affect us?
I think that technology does evolve, but it's important to remember that culturally, we often use the word evolve or evolution in ways that are completely counter to Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, to which I am very much a subscriber. And I think that technology actually evolves very much the way organisms evolve, which is to say randomly, meaninglessly, and endlessly. We are not the crown of creation. We're just the result of a lot of accidents. That was Darwin's take. You know, that's at the core of Darwin's theory of evolution. And I think our technology is like that. I think our technology is actually random, completely, often largely completely random. And new technologies are called into emergence, often as not, by someone's high hopes for the marketplace. And they then arrive, and they either take off or they don't. But when they do take off, by no means do they go in those directions imagined by their inventors or manufacturers. They change things radically in human society in ways that no one ever anticipated. The biggest changes that technology brings to us are, by and large, entirely unanticipated. And then we're left trying to legislate after the fact to try to come to terms with rampant social change in one sphere or another. But almost never are technologies legislated into existence.
William Gibson is the author of Neuromancer, Zero History, and many other novels. His nonfiction books include Distrust That Particular Flavor,